Hello and welcome to another edition of To Fintech and Beyond, the podcast brought to you by Tribe. I'm Alex Reddish and joining us this week is the fintech expert Sarah Kochansky. We'll be tackling the tricky topic of expansion, specifically taking your fintech stateside, a realistic goal or the stuff of nightmares. Good morning. Welcome to another episode of To Fintech and Beyond, the podcast brought to you by Tribe Payments. My name is Alex Reddish, the MD, and I'm here today with Sarah Kochansky, who I hope I pronounced your surname correctly, but welcome and good morning.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Today, we're going to focus on taking fintech stateside, the allure of the US market, a bit about international expansion, obviously very topical as we go through the sort of various iterations of payments and its evolution. Before we do that, it'd be great to get a bit of an introduction to yourself, where you've been, what you're doing now, and why we're having this conversation.
So my background I've been in fintech for like over 10 years, which is slightly terrifying. When I actually added up where I got my first job in fintech, I was like, oh my God. I started off working inside a fintech company, which made some of the earliest software for mobile banking apps, did that for a bit, and then decided I'd actually rather be outside the industry. So did various roles as a researcher and an analyst, fell into working for a company called 11FS, which some of your listeners may know, a global consultancy, where I headed up their market and competitor strategy. So that's where a lot of my expertise in kind of international fintech markets grew and developed. We had clients there. We helped launch products in their non-native markets and also clients that were working, you know, across multiple markets at the same time. And then from there, I moved to a company called Founders Factory, which was actually an accelerator and venture building studio. So that was really interesting, spending a lot of time with fintechs that were kind of very, very early stage and finding out their ambitions. And then in June of this year, I took the step to go freelance. So I'm now a sort of an independent fintech strategy consultant, which is brilliant because it means I get to do all the sort of work I've always loved to do, advising clients on their fintech strategy, but also combining it with a bit of my first love, which is the research analysis and writing reports. And most recently, I've actually been working with the Arizona Fintech Council, which is perfect alignment for this topic of conversation today.
Well, I think We've got the expert in the house. Before we dig into the sort of the US expansion stuff like that, leaning on that sort of 11FS experience a little bit, were there key common triggers for when expansion was a sensible move forward? I appreciate this wasn't in the question list, but listening to your introduction, it's quite an interesting way to start the conversation.
It's a really interesting one because it depends why the fintech wants to expand and who their target market is. So the allure of the US, if you like, is that it's a really big market. That's generally why people want to go there. You've got, you know, an economy of 23 trillion. You've got 330 million people, all of whom need access to services and all of whom need businesses. That means you need a lot of businesses to serve them, essentially. So that's normally why people want to go there. The question sort of happens as, what do you need to scale? So if you're going after retail customers and you're kind of in the UK, then depending on your niche, there's usually enough retail customers here for you to build a good base. And it actually takes you slightly longer, is my point, to decide that you want to expand to another large market. If you're a B2B company, then you might make that decision a bit earlier because the number of target customers you have would be lower. And so you need to move quicker into a larger market just to find enough customers that exist, basically, to get a high enough target market size.
Which makes sense. So obviously you regard the stats there around the size of total addressable market and sort of general GDP or market caps. But like, do you think there are notional reasons why people choose the US beyond people and money? Like, is there a technological advancement or anything like that?
There's a couple of other things. I think one is accurate and one is misguided. So I think one is that the US is definitely behind a lot of Europe in particularly some of the infrastructure pieces. But even on the consumer retail side, you've still got people using an awful lot of checks, for example. I know that example is given a lot, but it's true. Real-time payments are still not a thing. You know, they're coming, they're in patchy parts. People have built real-time payments on top of a very archaic, creaky system, whereas here in the UK, for example, our national payment system can handle real-time payments. So that makes you think that if you've got a product that's done well in Europe and then you're going to a market that's slightly further behind, it's you're not too late, I guess, is what my point. So if you spent 3 years building a client base in Europe and then you go to the US, you're at the same point as where you started in Europe. The other one that I think is slightly misguided is that people look at the US and go, oh, well, they're English speaking, you know, it's a similar sort of place, particularly for a UK business, go, oh, it's kind of similar to the UK. That is completely wrong. It is not. And it's true. Every country in the world has different financial habits, whether that's individuals, retail customers, or whether it's businesses. But I think people look at the US and go, oh, well, it's English speaking, and they kind of have a similar culture to us, you know, in a lot of ways in terms of buying, spending habits, you know, credit, payments, et cetera, that then it's a good target. That often turns out to be wrong.
That feels a bit naive, to be honest. So I was going to ask a bit about nuances and consumer requirements. So we've accepted the technology gap, which I completely agree with, you know, chip and pin, contactless, magstripe, all of those examples are prevalent in whatever conference we choose to go to these days. But I think my semblance of understanding from our expansion into the US is a bit that there are complications or nuances that aren't necessarily always anticipated. And actually, the consumer expectation versus the technological debt is not always aligned, in the sense that a US customer is aware of a Cash App or a, you know, a Venmo-like product, and actually they notice the delta in technology a bit more. Like, are you seeing that in terms of the consumer versus the nuance of the offering?
I think that's probably true to a certain extent. A large percentage of the US population is ready for kind of Apple Watch, you know, using that kind of payments. Like, you know, I don't take a card when I go out anymore, and then I end up somewhere in South Wales with my mum and being like, oh, I can't pay. Because they don't take contactless, and they don't, you know, and I don't carry cash. And I think there is a reasonable size of the population that's ready for that. I think there's a couple of things that get in the way. One, as we talked about before, the US infrastructure is not necessarily there and ready to take it. The merchants don't have access to the technology that they need, you know, whether that's hardware or software, or the education possibly as well, kind of understanding it. And I think, whilst, you know, I say that, yes, I think some consumers are ready, there is still quite a large trust gap, I think, in the US of consumers for new payment mechanisms. And there more so, I'd say, probably than in some parts of Europe. I mean, the percentage of people in the UK who don't want to use contactless, you know, is still significant, but I don't think it's as significant as in the US. And I think part of that, and this, you know, I may step on some toes here, I may get some, you know, angry tweets. I think that's to do with the size of the bank lobby in the US and how powerful it is and how it works very, very hard at keeping innovation within its own you know, businesses, within its own ring base. So innovation must come from JP Morgan Chase or Goldman Sachs. We do not want any of these little interlopers in here who might have some great ideas, and we will work really, really hard to keep them out. And we're quite successful at doing that. And I think that can kind of hinder the spread of solutions that people might adopt kind of organically. In the way that, you know, the perfect example is, and I know it's given a lot, but in London, we all got so used to tapping to go in and out of, you know, public transport, that when you just switch the Oyster card for your, you know, debit card, you're like, oh, well, that's what I do. I'm used to that habit. And you just saw other people doing it, became very organic. When it's very hard for merchants to implement those solutions because the banks won't enable them to do it, or because the providers can't do it, then it's harder for consumers to adopt them and follow through.
I think the perception you get being in this industry is that the Bay, or now some that's in Miami or New York or whatever, pushes out so much innovation that it should just be ubiquitous. And actually, these are pockets of acceptance as opposed to the general consumer.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think to go back to the point about what makes America or the US so attractive is also what can make it very, very hard. It's very, very big. And it's actually very, very fragmented. So it's a bit like saying, I honestly believe this, like, I'm going to do Europe. Because Europe is Europe, without kind of taking into account that Germany, Spain, France, Italy, you know, all have very, very different approaches to, you know, infrastructure, approaches to finance. Yes, they all take the euro, but that, so what? You know, yeah, every state in the US takes the dollar, but so what? It's big, habits are different across the country, regulation is different across the country. You know, for many, many types of fintech business, you do have to get licensed in every single state. And, you know, getting a license, whatever kind of license it is, wherever you are in the world, even here in the UK, where the FCA and the PRA do try to make it quite easy, they are kind of on the side of businesses to get regulated. It takes a lot of resources. When you're a startup, those resources can be money, but it's more often the time, the people you need to spend going through documents, filling in documents, getting the evidence, you know, whatever the individual regulator requires. If you've got to do that 50 times, then getting across the entire country is incredibly difficult.
We had that with a couple of our clients in MTL licensing, just trying to get, you know, anything crypto related warrants that. Which I guess brings us neatly onto a bit of a discussion about barriers to entry, the nuances of fragmented regulation. But are there anything else that you would consider a sort of a hurdle to overcome?
So I talked about the culture and really understanding who you're going after and knowing what your target market is. And, it, you know, if your target market is tech savvy Californians and their consumers, then you're a bit late. So, you know, if your market is merchants desperate for, you know, real-time payment solutions that enable their customers to make payments when they're offline because there's no internet connectivity, then you've probably got a better chance. So I think it's the barrier is don't assume the whole of America is the same. Know who your target market is. I think on the regulatory side, yes, fragmentation is one thing. I think the other thing that some companies fail to sort of get their heads around is that US regulation is more rules-based. European regulation as a whole tends to be more principles-based. So that generally means that you have more freedom in Europe. In the US, they work by enforcement. So you don't necessarily know you're doing something wrong until either you get in trouble for it or somebody in the same business as you gets in trouble for it. I mean, you mentioned crypto. That's a great example. Coinbase being called up by the SEC for listing securities. Well, nobody's really clear what a security actually is in the US anyway. So everybody else who offers exactly the same products that Coinbase does is watching like a hawk, because if Coinbase goes down, then everybody else is going to have to change on top of it. But that's an incredibly difficult environment to do business in when you're launching something and you've literally no idea if the regulator is going to come along in 6 months' time and say you can't do that anymore.
One of our clients actually has segregated their businesses for that very reason. The regulatory oversight from the US could by de facto extend to their entire global operation unless they were to ring fence the product offering that they were delivering to the US. The other thing that we came across was things like Durbin that I think you're notionally aware of it being in the payment space, but actually, how do you comply with it? The telcos were incredibly slow. Like going to a telco and be like, yeah, we want to launch this product in 6 months. They're like, great, due diligence will take 8 and we'll try and fit you in 2024. And you're like, welcome to US FinTech. But it's been a bit of a wild ride for us, I think, but hopefully we're nearly there.
I think one other point, just by talking about regulation, I have a little bit of a thing for regulation, is multiple regulators. So there are, in the UK, we do have multiple regulators, FCA, PRA, Bank of England, for example, but they tend to work together. They tend to kind of know who's, this is my job, that's your job. Oh, we're overlapping here, that's fine. We'll have kind of a joint agreement on how we're going to do this. In the US, the regulators seem to fight each other half the time. So you've got the OCC and the SEC and then the state governments, the state banks and the state central banks all conflicting with each other. So one says you can do something. So the OCC's FinTech charter was a perfect example of that. And then another comes along and said, nah, we're not going on board with that. Like, that's not going to work here. And how do you navigate that when it's actually the people at the very, very top can't even agree on what they want to allow in the country as a whole?
It seems like we've gone full circle back to lobbying, isn't it? But
sorry.
No. I think it might.
So
on that basis, tell me a bit about the Arizona FinTech Council.
Yeah, so basically the Arizona FinTech Council is a very, very similar principle to the FCA's FinTech Sandbox here in the UK. So it is a temporary sort of like regulatory safe harbor, basically. So companies can come work in the sandbox to test new FinTech products and services without any regulatory oversight, essentially, or kind of, you know, with the freedom to know that they're not going to be penalized, you know, whatever, for whatever they're doing, so long as it's within the confines of that sandbox. I think Arizona was the first US state to actually launch a FinTech sandbox back in 2018. But since then, you've kind of got quite a few, actually. The difference between Arizona's and maybe like Utah or Nevada's is that Arizona will allow applications from FinTechs anywhere in the world. So you as a UK company could apply to the Arizona FinTech sandbox. The way it works is, you know, you apply, the council looks at your application, you're invited to come and pitch, and then you pitch in front of a group of banks, sort of some national, some regional. And the aim of that sandbox is for you to, for the banks to meet the fintechs and then for them to go away and work on a proof of concept together, which again is a really good way if you're looking to enter the US market is to do it with a partner. So if you go in there and you partner with Chase and you run a proof of concept and Chase goes, yeah, this is great, then that's hugely beneficial to you. Also, you know, Chase can help you understand the regulatory requirements. You've got that partner on board. You've got their resources on board. So it's a really, you know, it's a really great initiative. It's a really good way for European fintechs to get in front of a load of banks all at the same time in, you know, in you have an hour, you know, with them, you pitch, and then we do sort of networking drinks as well, so people can, you know, mingle afterwards. So yeah, if there are any European fintechs thinking about moving to the US or have already made their first steps in the US, then, you know, get in touch with me. Go Google it, you'll find it, Arizona FinTech Council. But yeah, it's just a really good way to help you overcome some of those hurdles we've already discussed.
Why do you think Arizona wanted to do it? What do you think the inception or creation idea was?
So my understanding of it is, and obviously I'm the European advisor, so I've come in slightly later, but my understanding of it is basically that the Attorney General at the time was really wanted to kind of build the fintech industry in Arizona, wanted to encourage, you know, hubs to develop outside of New York and San Francisco. We have the same thing in the UK. You know, London is considered the hub, but we have, you know, Fintech Wales, we have Fintech Scotland. And it was just basically Arizona realized that it had all these resources around it. So Arizona has a great university. They're part of the council as well. Has great support from kind of local, you know, governmental initiatives that kind of will help as well, provide those kind of, I suppose, the other stuff you need. So you need regulation, you need money, but you kind of also need a talent pipeline. You need, you know, somewhere to have an office. You need to know that the local regulators are on board in the US particularly. So I think it kind of was driven by a combination of the, you know, the governor at the time wanting to build fintech and being receptive to my client, which is, you know, the partner and one of the co-founders, it's called CCG Catalyst, going along and saying, like, we should do this. So, yeah, it's generally kind of a way to build a hub for fintech outside of those core places. And it's, you know, a good, cheaper place to be.
Yeah, which matters, cool. Yeah.
Hi, it's Alex here, and just a quick word from me to promote our brand new report, Solving the Post-Pandemic's Payment Puzzle, How Can Merchants and Acquirers Satisfy Consumer Demand? Based on a survey of 400 merchants across 5 key European markets, the aim of this research is to understand what payments issues and initiatives merchants are focused on as they resolve to meet consumer demand. We also dive into areas where merchants are seeking support and how payment partners and their acquirers can help. Head over to our website, trypayments.com, where you can download it for free.
Have you seen any, or can you talk to, and I appreciate this is a relatively new endeavor for you, but any of the things that have gone through it in terms of vertical or specific business?
I can't talk to any specific companies, but what I can say is that the council are completely open to any kind of companies that want to apply. They are genuinely looking for ideas. And back to a point that we covered earlier, they are aware that the US is behind and that Europe is further ahead. And they are looking for, therefore they know that European companies might be the best way to help them, you know, speed up whichever part of their digital transformation they're looking to do. So the banks, and then as I said, this huge range of banks from kind of like huge, you know, national banks down to sort of smaller regional community banks, each will be looking for different sorts of things to better serve their own customers.
Do you think the US can learn anything from European fintech, the neobanks in the UK and various markets? Like, do you think there's things they could do better being 3 years behind?
I think the neobanks is a really interesting point. I think the reason that European neobanks haven't had much success in the US is their failure to understand the US consumers partly, and also the success of the existing providers there. I mean, if you look at Chime's customer base, I think it's like 12 million or something now. it's done really, really well. So it would have picked up that, you know, entire swathe of, you know, first movers and early adopters. What is, you know, a Monzo or a Starling or a Revolut going to come in and offer that Chime isn't already doing? Arguably, Revolut is slightly different because of it kind of, it's, we're going to do everything approach. So if you want your crypto next year, insurance next year, current account next year, travel money, then you know, there's possibly a space for that. Although thus far, they haven't made a huge impact in the US. But I think just the individual, the specific banks, the US banks are looking at them going, well, we've kind of done all that and more to serve our market. So if you look at the services that got Chime, it's, you know, huge raft of first customers. It was free accounts because free accounts weren't a common thing in the US. You know, get paid early. Well, that takes us right back to real-time payments, like get paid on the day your company pays you as opposed to 4 days later when the bank sat on it and made some interest. You know, credit building products. Well, yeah, you know, Monzo can do that, but Chimes is, you know, leaps and bounds ahead. What are they going to offer? So I think the new banks, I would say, haven't got a lot to teach the US market. I think, you know, kind of, with the exception perhaps of distribution tactics, with the exception perhaps of that kind of word of mouth, organic distribution, build up the hype about your product, get people on board with your brand, hot coral cards, metal cards, golden tickets. I'm trying to think of all the different campaigns that the banks have used over the years.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the principle of a neobank is to attract the tech savvy. You make an incredibly valid point, therefore. And actually, if the tech savvy are being serviced by the incumbents within the US market, total addressable market actually becomes those that wouldn't be normally attracted to your product, which are well served by a Chase or a, you know, Goldman Sachs, and therefore, or an American Express even. Like, therefore, actually, it's a very different competitive landscape.
Yeah, and I would actually say that when I'm talking about US banking, I think Chase and Goldman Sachs are actually very innovative. I think that they're probably, you know, they've moved very, very fast, and you know, they've got a lot of customers who are very, very happy with them and look at Chime and go, oh, no, I don't need that. You know, Chime has targeted that market section of the market, which is A, tech savvy, B, kind of either objects to fees or is under, you know, it doesn't have much money, can't afford to pay bank fees. So that it's a slightly different market to Chase. I'd say Chase is very innovative. And a lot of its products and services, okay, yes, it's a first attempt at a neobank out there, didn't work. But then it's just doubled down on serving the existing customers it has very, very well to make sure that they have absolutely no need to look anywhere else for kind of an innovative customer-centric banking product. It's sort of the mid-range community banks that are perhaps at risk from the neobanks. But again, the community banks have very, very, they're called community banks for a reason. They have very, very loyal customers.
So what do you see as the opportunities of going into the US for payments people? Like, what do you think has real chance of success?
I think infrastructure players, definitely. I think people who can, you know, help.
Good to know.
Yeah, I wasn't primed to say that.
Yeah.
But I think it's the underlying kind of, how do you make things smoother, easier, and faster underneath? Because at the top end, they've done really, really well. You've got Cash App. You know, the other thing I think that people forget when looking at the US payments and banking market on the consumer side, certainly, is PayPal is huge. Like, you're competing with PayPal. Like, you know, PayPal is essentially a neobank for all intents and purposes. So is Cash App, really. I mean, yeah, okay, there are some bits missing, but if you can invest, you can spend, you know, you can get direct deposit. Is that not basically what most people use their bank product for? So I think kind of the front end has been done very well. I think the underlying infrastructure, there's still some, you know, room to play for all that, you know, the likes of Galileo and Marqeta have made their mark. I think one that is really interesting and hugely ripe for disruption is transaction banking. Just the whole, actually, that's all over the world. I think if anybody can innovate in transaction banking, then they are sitting on a gold mine.
Yeah, if you see the likes of Move and Wade Arnold, like trying to change some of those things in terms of the infrastructure, I think it's been an interesting exercise for us, because actually taking European clients to the US, trying to find product ubiquity is actually very difficult because of some of those, I'm going to say market failures, for want of a better term, but therefore actually it creates us a new set of problems to solve, because you're not a native American infrastructure provider. So it's been a bit of a challenge, let's say.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's the thing, kind of working out which wire connects to which and where and when and why, combined with regulation, means that you need an awful lot of resource actually on the ground just trying to pick it all apart, which means that you often do need a partner to go into the country with, because doing it on your own is, unless you're hugely resourced, it's very, very difficult.
We end this show always with a consistent question with the idea that we get varying answers. So the last question I have for you today is kind of, what is the one thing in fintech you think is yet to happen?
Other than transaction banking, you know, moving into the 20th century, let alone the 21st century. I think there's two things. On the consumer side, I don't think fintech has actually really helped people manage their wealth better yet. I don't think we've seen an actual solution that helps me get the advantages of somebody earning six figures a year. I don't have access to the tax breaks. I don't have easy access to investments. I don't have access to advice. Like, those things sort of exist in bits and in parts, but a holistic, like, help me make my money work better for me, I've yet to see. And that could be one product or services, or it could be, you know, or it could be a holistic solution, or it could be a better connectivity between the existing players in the ecosystem. The other thing that I think fintech could make a huge difference for, and it's not entirely down to fintech, but I think fintech is kind of nudging this particular space, is sort of AML and KYC. As I said, it's not entirely in the fintech's hands. There's a lot to be done with kind of regulators. But identity versus privacy is a huge conversation right now. You've got growing amounts of fraud. Like, how do I prove who I am without telling you huge amounts of information that I don't want you to have and you don't need to know, so that you can deliver me services safely, but you also check I'm not a money launderer? And how do I, you know, where's this supposed digital identity that I can port between every, you know, online entity? Because we've been promised that for, you know, decades. And I have four different government gateways, which for international listeners is like a UK access code that you're supposed to be able to use to access all UK government services. But they seem to issue you a new one every time you go to a different department. So I think those two are linked, but kind of like identity and, you know, fraud management, fraud detection, anti-money laundering, all those things would be a lot easier if we could find a way to safely prove who we are without handing over, you know, too much information, including our blood type and our inside leg measurement.
This kind of EID wallet principle that keeps being banded on. I don't normally talk after this question, but I think it's such an interesting subject. I think as a consumer, we're aware of cookies, we're aware of GDPR, but actually, you know, when you look into, for example, the terms and conditions within TikTok or things like that, the incredible things they can do with that data, they track your keystrokes, they track what other apps you have on your phone, like the reach of these big corporates now, and therefore the ability for them to, it's scary. Like I find it, as with a parent with young children, I find it quite scary because, you know, my children are already using the Google Home better than I am. So God help me in 5 years' time.
Well, yeah. I mean, and the thing is, people know that Google's American. People know that Meta's American. So they already know that their data is, there's a lot of their data being handled by a foreign entity. But how many people know that TikTok is Chinese? You know, it's in the terms and conditions. They're not hiding it, but it's, I can see why it's scary. I don't have children, but it scares me. So
I think that also on your first point, the generational transfer of wealth will now happen through the previous booms or whatever in housing and stuff like that. So actually that sort of mid-market wealth and capturing that, like I find it, you know, I've got my pension, I've got my ISA, I've got my bank account, I've got, you know, St. James's Place messaged me on LinkedIn, be like, let's all manage your money together. And I'm like, how does this really function in a modern society where I want to do this off my app and get sound independent advice versus a biased, I'm going to charge you 15 basis points for the privilege?
Yeah, I honestly, as somebody who's worked in this industry, as I said, for over 10 years, could afford financial advice. No idea where to start because I don't know who to trust, you know. So somebody could solve that problem. That would be great.
So where can we find a bit more about you, a bit more about the Arizona FinTech Council, and please point us to those best sources?
Yep. So you can find me on Twitter at Sarah Kachansky, or you can find me on LinkedIn at Sarah Kachansky. I assume the spelling of my name will appear with this podcast if people struggle to find me.
And I will double check it. Don't worry. Sarah, it's been a pleasure to listen in today, and thank you very much for the insights on the international expansion and also obviously the Arizona FinTech Council. And best of luck with the new endeavors.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.